And we're working.
Okay, ready to go. We thank you, Heavenly Father, for allowing us to meet here this evening. Please open up our minds and our hearts to this law, because all of the law is your law. We ask this through your Son, the Messiah. Do we have any announcements? Okay, Pete's got an announcement, and while he's coming up to the mic, I would just like to let the virtual audience know that I've had quite a few emails as far as how to get in contact with Gary and so on and so forth on this UCC stuff. We are trying to put something together. As soon as something is available, we'll let everybody out there know. But up until then, there's no phone number, there's no email, there's no nothing up at this time.
Okay, now last week, Gary's son mentioned two books. One book was Understanding Indispensable Paperwork by W.H. Lawrence. And supposedly it was published by LexisNexis. Turns out there's two LexisNexises. There's a LexisNexus, and there's a LexisNexis. And I think the LexisNexis is for the cars, and I think the LexisNexis is for legal stuff. At any rate, I spent more time than I can afford to on the internet trying to locate that book. I could not do that. So if anybody can get a reference to that and get it to me, I would appreciate that. We'll spread that information around. Either send it to Caleb or email me at plumcreekdogs@aol.com. That's P-L-U-M, Creek, C-R-E-E-K, dogs, D-O-G-S, at aol.com. The second book is Commercial and Debtor-Creditor Law. I did find that on the Alibris website, and that's Alibris, Alibris.com. And the book is Commercial and Debtor-Creditor Law, Selected Statutes. I was able to buy the 2005 edition. The ISBN number on that is 1-58778-840-3. I got that from Rose's Book Corner down in Tennessee somewhere, still don't know where in Tennessee, but it came in 1 week. I'm standing here holding it. And I paid $42 on my doorstep for it, and it lists at $55, and I did see several $55 new editions on the internet, but I got a new edition for $42 on my doorstep. So that is relatively easy to get. I found this Alibris website pretty easy to use. I tried using eBay. I could never crack the money code problem. I had to deal with paying for the thing with a Visa card. They want to use PayPal, and then they want to tap into your checking account with the automatic withdrawal, and I didn't want that. So if somebody can give me instructions on how to deal with eBay without having them tap your bank account, I'd appreciate an education on how to do that. But at any rate, Commercial and Debtor-Creditor Law is relatively easy to find. It just came this afternoon, and I haven't had time to even look into it to see what's in there. But I need help in getting a reference on that other book so we can spread that out to people on the internet and on the virtual audience.
Okay, that's it.
Okay, any other announcements? Okay, I guess not. Been working with Cindy and some other people on this nulla contendere plea in the criminal domain. Been talking to Gene Keating about it also. Gene has been doing some research. Cindy and Byron have been doing some research. Nothing but good stuff coming out of this. Cindy has been helping some people in criminal cases, both federal and state. They're using the nolle contendere plea. They have been talking to attorneys, out of four attorneys that are there for defendants in various cases. We now are to the point where two of the attorneys in different cases in different states have suggested that they have no problem whatsoever with putting in a motion for leave to withdraw any other pleas and enter a plea of nolle contendere with supporting a counterclaim and supporting evidence in lieu of that. But two of the attorneys have suggested strongly that they would prefer the client, the defendant, to put those motions, pleas, and documentation into the court, but that the attorneys will endorse or sign those pleadings so that they will appear into the court as though the attorney is approving them or bringing them. But the attorney suggests strongly that if the clients, i.e. the defendants, which in our case is the captain of the vessel acting for the defendant, has already drawn up the pleadings and already gotten the administrative procedure and evidence together, the attorney doesn't necessarily want to retype them and draw them. He says, just go ahead and put them in, submit them to me, I'll sign them, and then you can put them into the court. So we feel that this is a tremendous step forward in that, number one, the attorneys are recognizing the validity of these pleas of nolle contendere to bring a criminal case into a civil-type case, and we will show you with some of the research of Gene Keating how that comes about. Last week I was talking about some of these things, and one of the things that we did not talk about last week is ordinarily when you make your original appearance before the court in any case where they either drag you in there in handcuffs or you're just coming in as a result of a summons in a criminal case, the magistrate usually asks for a pleading. And of course we talked about the fact that in criminal there's only four pleadings that one has the ability to enter in criminal pursuant to the rules of procedure. And I believe we talked about that last week in that in Ohio, the criminal rule of procedure rule is Rule 11, pleas and rights upon plea. And under subprint A, it talks about the defendant may plead not guilty by reason of insanity, guilty, or with consent of the court, no contest. And so we'll talk about why a consent of the court is necessary for a plea of no contest as we go through the evening here. But in that initial appearance, the thought has come down, and we've talked about it in the past. Generally, the court has no complaint on record there in most of these court proceedings at that time, although the presumption is there is. And the point we're making is prior to the entry of a plea, you're still in an administrative process, not a quasi-judicial process, i.e., the court doesn't gain jurisdiction until it's got a meeting of the minds and a consent between both the plaintiff and the defendant. And if they only have the allegation of a charging instrument, an information, an indictment, a complaint, whatever, but the defendant has not come back and entered a plea yet, the court has not got a joinder to get subject matter jurisdiction over the issue. And so the issue comes up then, is there a way of dealing with this whole so-called criminal process administratively prior to the entry of a plea? And we believe there is. For instance, many, many times, particularly in federal courts, if they drag you in there, there are probably one or two or three people sitting in the court, usually in the back of the court, that you are aware maybe of their presence, particularly if there's no other cases going on, but you may not understand who is there and for what reason they are there. And of course, most of the patriots that have the traditional philosophy that it's an us versus them type of warfare going on here would probably believe that the people sitting in the back of the room are either Department of Justice people or IRS investigators or whatever that are there because they're part of the charging team, the plaintiff. And, of course, since they are, quote, your enemy, unquote, you don't want to have anything to do with them. However, remember what we've been suggesting for at least 2 to 3 years now is that when you are charged and given a summons or a warrant, they're actually coming out and they are actually giving you an honor. Because the only one in the courtroom that can resolve and settle and close the matter is the one who is there supposedly in the capacity of being a defendant. The reason this is true is since everything is backwards, the presumption is that whoever is there is the trustee for the defendant vessel, i.e. he's Captain Smith where the defendant vessel is Smith. And Captain Smith, being a trustee, has all the books, records, documents, and the power to settle and close this whole matter and make it go away. So the most important one in the courtroom is the guy that's led in there as the so-called defendant. And they are honoring him by giving him the opportunity in a public setting to settle and close whatever issue is before the court. Now, if that is the case, and this person of honor is in front of the magistrate in the original appearance, and there is no charging instrument that is really filed or registered in the court record officially, the other people sitting in the back of the court then that appear to be the IRS agents, the Department of Justice people, the marshals investigating, whatever it is, are there for one purpose. What is that purpose that those people are sitting there? Anybody got an idea? To see if you're an honor? In other words, they're just witnesses to observe what you're going to do? Is that it, Caleb? Okay, that's all? Anything else?
They'll probably proceed against you if you're not.
They'll proceed against you if you're not. Most likely, because you've got a duty to resolve it, right? What do you have to do to resolve it in the public venue? What have we been talking about? What has Victoria been talking about for a couple of years? What has to go on in the public venue? What are we there in court for? Let's say you've done your homework and you've done your administrative procedure and gotten that finished outside the tribunal prior to all these events happening. Because remember, Cindy said you're going to do your administrative procedure, you're going to wind it all up, you're going to get your certificate of protest, and then what are you going to do with it? Yeah, get your judicial review. Cindy suggested quite strongly that if it's a foreign judgment, like it probably is if you've gotten it, then in the federal district court you can open the $39 jacket to place all that evidence in that jacket. Okay? But why are you being arraigned in an alleged criminal case? What do you have to do to cause that to go away? Got a what?
Counterclaim.
Counterclaim. How are you going to do that? Well, you can enter the plea of nulla contendere, right? And then we can introduce it. But that, by the time you enter a plea of nulla contendere, what have you just done?
Agreed to the facts, for sure.
Yeah, you've agreed to the facts, but now it's judicial because they've got an offer and acceptance. What if you wanted to try to do this administratively before the court even got jurisdiction? In other words, the judge says enter a plea. But you haven't entered a plea. Do you have to enter a plea? Is there a better way to solve this case?
Go to your adversary first?
You did. You went to your adversary He never came back to you, so you got your certificate of protest. You might even have it in a jacket in the courtroom in the courtroom building in which they've allegedly drug you before a magistrate to be arraigned. There's some people sitting in the back of the court. Who the hell are these people? What have they got to do with you?
Your witnesses.
They're your witnesses. Why would they be your witnesses, and how can you make them your witnesses? Why are they there?
To bring forth the evidence.
To bring forth the evidence. What evidence are those people in the back of the courtroom? What did they gather, and what are they going to bring forth? Everything the agency told them, right? Aren't they going to be the relators, the witness in your case for the government? They're going to be the ones that will go out and say, yep, I investigated. I talked to policeman Freddie and FBI agent Joe and this guy over here and the guy's wife and the guy's kids and the guy's banker, and this is all the evidence we got. So they don't have any first-hand knowledge. They went out and they were gathering the evidence, and they're going to come into the case and they're going to act like a relator. They're going to relate what somebody else gave them, and they're going to put that evidence in the court, right? Who do they appear to be working for?
Prosecution.
The prosecution. Why are they working for the prosecution? If they're the relator, don't they have a fiduciary duty to get the facts and the evidence from both sides?
You didn't ask them.
So now you're standing in front of the magistrate and he wants a plea. What are you going to do?
Call your witnesses.
Your Honor, there appears to be someone in the courtroom to which I do not know what their names are and what their relationship is to these proceedings. If it pleased the court, would they introduce the parties that are in this room? After all, when you go to any meeting, isn't the first order of business to decide who's there and why they're there? Okay, if it turns out that we have somebody from the agency there which has not resolved and settled your matter, then, Your Honor, if it pleased the court, may I request that Relator Freddie be requested to go down to the clerk's office to bring forth documentation that is relevant to the proceedings herein to show that this matter has been settled and closed. Who's going to go get the information? The relator. Does he have a fiduciary duty to? Yes, because his job is to bring forth all the relevant information. Now, is the judge going to wander down there and get the information? No. But you're probably going to find, at least in a lot of the federal cases, that there is present in the room the parties whose fiduciary duty is to carry out these directives. Now, if he were to go get the information that the account has already been settled and closed before you enter a pleading, then the judge is going to look at the prosecution and say, is there any reason why we should not terminate this hearing? Because the court lacks jurisdiction if there is not a matter in dispute. And so it would not move forward in a judicial capacity. Okay? And I think that what we're doing is by failing to see what events are transpiring around us in these circumstances, we are losing a great opportunity to be able to resolve these issues administratively before the court even cranks up any kind of quasi-judicial proceedings. Yes, Caleb.
They don't necessarily even have to be sitting in the back. If I remember correctly, in a couple of my cases, they sat right up there at the defendant's table.
At the prosecution table.
Prosecution table, sure.
And the party sitting there was the investigator or the relator. And the purpose in finding out who this is so that you can avoid judicial proceedings, which are going to be more involved, and maintain and show that you have done everything you can to settle this matter in a civil administrative environment before it even gets going. And if you can do that and request that the relator bring the evidence into the court and submit it to the court for recognition, then you've accomplished everything you need to do without even turning judicial or quasi-judicial in what's happening. Okay, so we wanted to raise that issue to you, particularly if you're in a courtroom setting in which prior to any kind of entry of a plea, you might notice that there are parties around you in that courtroom that extend to you this opportunity if you're smart enough to understand it and take it. Okay, I believe last week when we talked about Gene Keating's arrest, we told you last Monday that Gene Keating was arrested the previous week, that by Friday afternoon, his buddies had filed a habeas corpus in his behalf, and that Friday before the sun went down and the court got dismissed, the sheriff in the county down south in Ohio here released him on the verbal phone call of a judge that said, get him out of here right now and tell him to meet with the probation department in Cuyahoga County up north on Monday morning. And so last week being Monday evening, I had not had any information, I believe, as to what happened to Gene other than to now tell you that when he went to that meeting up here in Cleveland on Monday morning, they arrested him and threw him in jail up here again. And so, again, another habeas corpus was entered into the courts up here, and Gene Keating was released on bond from jail. And the presumption is now somewhere down the road there's going to be some kind of a judicial hearing. Now, I had a chance to talk to Gene because to begin with, he was somewhat confused about some of the things that were going on. And Gene and I have had a long discussion about that, and Cindy Beers and I have had a big discussion about that. And it appears as though the following pretty much is what is happening in that case. And what happened and how it happened is very important for any of us that are doing any of this administrative process and trying to get a court data integrity board hearing to get the public to ratify what's going on in the private. Now, Gene, the reason he got out on Friday with the habeas corpus is because attached to the habeas corpus was a copy of Gene's administrative procedure, including the certificate of protest, when he administratively dealt with the probation department up here in Cuyahoga County, when Gene had accepted the offer for probation for value, returned it, asked for settlement and closure, and submitted an IBOE, an International Bill of Exchange, to settle and close any charges which might exist by way of offset through the unlimited exemption that the living man has. For about a year or a year and a half, Gene never reported verbally, by letter, or physically. He was not living in the area. He was a couple hundred miles south, and nobody bothered him. And then all of a sudden, he got picked up by the sheriff of the county down south, allegedly on the new charge of probation violation and escape. And the escape charge, being a brand new charge, was a felony charge against him. Now, we suggested strongly that the reason that they charged him could have been a number of things. Number one, Gene has a tendency from time to time to speak out like they, the government, are still the enemy, and the kind of, quote, we've got to get the bastards, unquote, type attitude is one of terrorism, which means, Gene, are you double-minded in that you go to peace and try to settle your public cases, but on the other side, you are talking up one side of your head peace and the other side of your head warfare? Are you a double-minded man, dangerous in all respects, and should the government be arresting you and bringing you in to see exactly where it is, you might create a problem for society in and with the issue of, quote, terrorism, unquote, because that's what people do who are at warfare by, quote, enemy, unquote, type issues. And the other side of the coin is that Gene Keating asked the probation department to settle and close his case. Gene went through his private administrative process, and the probation department never brought a counterclaim, never came out with any issue that they had in objection to settling and closing it. So Gene figured, hey, on the private side, it's a done deal. But we know that the public has to be able to recognize this private settlement through some kind of a public pronouncement. And so the next issue is, well, did they use the arrest of Gene Keating as a kind of colorable manner of providing a public hearing for Gene in order to have the court act in the capacity of a data integrity board to recognize that the probation was in fact settled and closed? And if that was their intent, then did they charge Gene with these new crimes just as an artifice and a scheme to test Gene to see if he's going to go to warfare and argue with them, or whether he's going to bring in the acceptance and the counterclaim into the court and ask for the data integrity board hearing? Now, if the presumption that Gene, the vessel, is now arrested with the arrest warrant, and Gene, the man who is in jail, is the captain of the vessel and has a duty to bring the issues that the parties associated with the vessel might have to the court, then they're keeping Gene in jail as a witness, not because he's the defendant, but because he's a witness. He's the captain of the vessel, the trustee that should bring in all of the counterclaims and the evidence. And if Gene's petition for writ of habeas corpus brings forth his administrative procedure showing in good faith that he had tried to settle the probation issue, and that in Gene's view, the probation issue is now by agreement of the parties gone away, then the one they have in jail is Gene, the captain of the vessel, a trustee who is now appearing to be in honor. In other words, he's assisted the public officials in resolving their issue. Can we keep a third party who is in honor in prison? The answer is no. So the judge said, hey, you can't keep that guy in jail. He rebutted the presumption that you think he's wrong. So let him out of there. But because it's not resolved publicly, you have him come up and meet with the administrative agency that caused this criminal charges to get filed and see if they can resolve it administratively before we hold a court hearing. So Gene was told to go up and meet with them on Monday. Now, when Gene got up there, the reason that Gene wasn't called into the court is because the tribunal only calls people in during one of several circumstances. The first circumstance is we call them in because the two parties that are coming in are in agreement, and the reason they're coming before the magistrate is so that the magistrate can make sure both parties are in agreement, and then the magistrate can issue a public pronouncement, which is the second witness, which ratifies the agreement. The second reason you go before the magistrate in a tribunal is because the parties are not in agreement, and one or both of the parties are in dishonor to the process. And so, in the case of Gene Keating last week, with the issue of whether or not the probation issue had been settled, the record now shows by Gene Keating's evidence in support of his habeas corpus that he believed it was settled. But because the court had a brand new filing of new criminal complaints, the presumption is that the probation department doesn't believe it's settled. So we don't have the first condition that we suggested a tribunal would be interested in bringing them in if it's settled and agreed. Because it appears as though Gene thinks it's settled and the probation department must think it's not settled. So we don't have an agreement, so we can't hold a court hearing yet. Let's go to the second issue, that even though there isn't an agreement, one of the parties are in dishonor. Well, we are going to assume and presume that the party from the probation department and the state prosecutor actually in good faith assumed and presumed that we needed to bring Keating in. And we will also assume that because Keating has showed all of his evidence of trying to settle this, we'll assume he's attempting in good faith to settle and close this issue too. So at this stage of the game, the presumption of the magistrate and the tribunal is both parties are acting in good faith. They just don't agree yet. So before we hold a hearing, let's get them together and see what happens in that hearing. Maybe they can resolve it without having to come in here and us having to knock heads together. So they sent them to the hearing so that Keating could again present to the probation people his records. And the probation people can look at Keating's records and then look at their own records, and between the two parties they could come up with some kind of an agreement to settle and close this matter. And if they could do that, then they would both petition the court to hold a hearing and have the hearing officer, the magistrate, ratify their agreement. The other possibility is at this hearing, either Keating is going to dishonor the probation department by arguing, yelling, screaming, and fighting against them, or else the probation department is going to dishonor Keating and either not respond to his paperwork or not bring a counterclaim or act honorably. And if, irregardless of what happens, if one of the parties is in dishonor, the other party has no remedy except to petition the magistrate at the court for a hearing to have the magistrate have the other party show cause why they should not cure their dishonor or rule for the party who is in honor. Because remember, we've said that with the financial conditions being what they are, where everybody is basically in an incapacity to pay their debts and obligations at law, there is no ability for the law to execute anything, so the facts are on the moon. The only thing we're looking for here is honor and dishonor between the parties procedurally. And so we're getting together in the hearing to see if one of the parties will dishonor the other one, so that the party who has been in honor can go before the court and have the court grant it an order in its favor because it stayed in honor. So Gene Keating went to the probation department hearing. If he would have done the right thing, I believe he did. I have no reason to believe he did not. He would walk in there with his record and he would humbly ask the people at probation to show cause why, since there is already a stipulation here by a notary public of a protest, why it is that the probation department has a claim in substance against this document, this certificate of protest, or whether the probation department can show where Gene's records are not correct. Now, from talking to Gene, he said, it appeared from the moment I arrived at the probation department that they were not interested in talking to me about anything. They just appeared angry and decided that they were going to throw me in jail. And that's what they did. They threw me in jail. What just went on?
Two things. One, they dishonored and they were testing him also.
Okay, two things. Caleb, you're right. Number one, they were testing him. And number two, they dishonored Gene. Okay? Now, if they dishonored Gene, what does that give Gene the ability to do? Take it before the magistrate for a ruling, presumably now in his favor, because they dishonored him. Okay? Now, last week I was talking to Cindy Beers, and she said in the research that they've done, there is a United States prosecutor's manual that is put out by the Department of Justice for all U.S. prosecutors and assistant prosecutors. And in that manual, it states emphatically that if a party, if a defendant comes in and enters a motion for leave of court to be allowed to enter a no contest plea, that the prosecutor, the U.S. prosecutor, must oppose that motion for leave of court to enter a nulla prosequi or a nulla contendere plea. Must oppose it. What is that telling you? The U.S. prosecutor must intentionally dishonor the request to enter a plea of no contest. Why?
See if the quote-unquote defendant will argue.
Same answer, Caleb. They're testing him, and they're purposely giving a dishonor, aren't they? The manual didn't say that you must file a motion opposing it with a good claim. It said you must oppose it. If you oppose it for no good reason or no claim, it's a dishonor. When they are instructed to dishonor the other party, what should be the automatic outcome of that dishonor? Pardon? You go home. The judge ought to rule in favor of the defendant who entered the no contest plea. In other words, they're being told that if the defendant is intelligent, honorable enough, and some other conditions we'll talk about, in terms of entering a no contest plea, you must become dishonorable by definition of your acts so that the defendant can win or prevail in his no contest plea so that the issue will be dismissed, discharged, or set off and concluded. So it's an automatic win. They're being told, you guys go into a dishonor so that the other side can win. So when Gene showed up at the probation office, the probation office could do one of three things. They could agree with Gene, oh yeah, Gene, we really screwed up. Let's go before the judge and have him get rid of this probation for you. Good answer. Second, we're going to dishonor you. We don't care what you did. You're an idiot. We're going to throw your ass in jail. Dishonor. What's the result of a dishonor? The same result as you'd get if they agreed with you. Because you're going to win. What would happen if the probation department would have raised a counterclaim? Then the negotiations would go on back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and we can't go to the magistrate to get a resolution yet because we're still in negotiations. And so if they agree with you, you win. If they dishonor you, you win. Or if there's a counterclaim, it's just like under the old common law pleadings, it goes back and forth and back and forth until an issue is joined and we can resolve our way out of the issues. Now, if Gene goes in there and says, look at all of the nice paperwork I've got, will you agree with me to go in front of the judge and let's get this wound up? And they go, yeah, Gene, let me put my arm around your shoulder. I'll walk you down to the court. We'll get you out of here before 10 a.m. Don't you think next week everybody'd ask Gene what he did and everybody'd be coming in there following the same procedure again? And so they go, no, we can't let the cat out of the bag by acknowledging that this guy's right. We have to appear to oppose him. But we will oppose him in such a way that creates a dishonor so that he's got to win. The problem is, if they create the dishonor, then if Gene's confused and doesn't see that they're actually helping him win, he will go into argument, fighting, and dishonor, which will cancel their dishonor, and then he'll be on his way to jail. So basically, what we're showing in Gene Keating's case is, before you see the light at the end of the tunnel, it always appears the darkest. So Gene was in jail two times in this issue. Now, what got him out of jail the second time? Habeas corpus. What was attached to the habeas corpus? The same documentation showing that Gene tried to settle and close the case. Which means, hello, they threw you in jail, but they can't keep you in jail because they threw you in jail on a dishonor, not on an honor, so we got to get you out of there, but then you're going to go before the court. Now, Gene's had no court date. The issue is, what happens if they don't summons Gene to a court date for 2, 3, 4 months? That's another dishonor, because what's going on is Gene's process matures in a period of time. Now, why would the probation department have an interest at this time in going before the court? Would it? No. If the probation department goes before the court right now, is it going to win or lose? It's going to lose. So why would the prosecutor of the probation department ask the court to set a hearing? They wouldn't. Who's got to ask the court to set a hearing? Gene. What if he fails to state a claim? Then he loses because his action times out and his ability to get a remedy disappears with time. He runs out of time and then they're right back at him again. Understand what's going on? Now, let's see how this compares to what happened with Victoria's two guys with their tax problems a couple of years ago. Remember? Remember, whatever it was that happened to these guys, they said, okay, we're going to tender this bill of exchange for settlement and closure. And as soon as they did that, the IRS sent them a written notice of lien and levy, didn't they? Why did they send them a written notice of lien and levy? That was the opportunity to ask for a hearing. Why is that an opportunity to ask for a hearing? Because the government cannot seize rights to property or property without giving you a hearing, if you want one. And since you settled and closed the case, at least administratively, by tendering the bill of exchange for set-off and adjustment, the IRS says, there's nothing wrong with seizing the property now, because if we give notice of lien and levy, it gives this guy the ability to ask the court for a hearing, and he needs to have his public hearing right now before the time expires to ratify his private agreement. And since he's entitled to the hearing, let's invoke the hearing by looking like we're going to take everything he has in the world away from him, like he did something wrong instead of something right. So they give a notice of lien and levy, and by their statutes, as soon as they give a notice of lien and levy, as soon as they give him the notice of lien and levy, he has 10, 20, 30 days to request that administrative appeal, which is going to be his hearing. If he fails to request the hearing for the appeal, then what he's basically saying is, I'm going to give up and subrogate my settlement. Which means the government can step in by consent of the party by his failure to ask for the hearing for the Data Integrity Board review and go ahead and seize the property as though this guy doesn't care. And if he doesn't care, we don't care what his reason is, but he subrogated his rights. And as long as he's involved in subrogation, we can come out and apply our priority taking of the property. Well, what did they do with Gene Keating when they arrested him down south a week and a half ago? They seized the property. What does Gene Keating have to do? Request a hearing. I don't know if Gene has requested a hearing yet, because the hearing is going to be before the court. Gene put in two habeas corpuses, he got out of two jails, and he had a physical appearance before the probation board. But has Gene filed a formal request for an appellate hearing? Not to my knowledge. How much longer does he have before his time runs out? Probably the remaining part of 30 days maximum. If he fails to request the hearing, is he subrogating his case? Most likely. Why did they throw him in jail? Because he's the only guy that can go in front of the magistrate to petition the magistrate for the remedy. And they threw him in jail as an invitation to come on in, request your hearing in front of the magistrate so you can get your remedy, and we will chalk the probation off of the board, which is what Gene asked them to do. So everything is backwards. Why did the woman at probation throw Gene in jail when he went to the probation hearing? So that Gene was given his remedy on a silver platter. Or does Gene think that woman has no right to throw me in prison? I'm going to file a Title 42 action against her. If he tries to file a 42 action against her, is the federal court judges going to dismiss his complaint down the road? You bet, because by her throwing him in jail, it wasn't to harm Gene, it was to give him his remedy if he had knowledge and understanding to petition the court to get it, because she dishonored, which is a second witness that they intend to allow him to get his remedy. What was the first witness that Gene had in his hot little hands that the court ought to abate the probation proceedings? His administrative proceeding. What was his second witness coming out of his opponents that the court ought to grant him an order abating those proceedings? The dishonor by throwing him in jail. So it's the very act in action that you might think that they're doing that's outside of their authority that is causing you damage and harm, which is actually the admission on the record that you're entitled to your relief and remedy. You got to see what they're doing backwards. Now remember, we said that Gene Keating had already got one administrative settlement out of probation. And we warned and said, what happens if Gene Keating comes in and treats the new charges as a completely separate issue and case and just accepts it and returns it and sends a new bill of exchange? What happens then? We're back in no man's land again. We've only got one witness to a new event. And this is going to keep going on over and over and over again. By the time he administratively settles that, they're going to do it again a third time. He'll settle that. They're going to do it again a fourth time and settle that. Because Gene Keating is not following what we talked about in the terms of the word and phrase from a couple of weeks ago, non sequitur. His second sequence of issues of treating the new charges as an isolated, separate event is non sequitur to having already administrated this problem and concluded it administratively to begin with. And the second event was a test to see if he's going to act sequitur to his previous settlement or non sequitur and be a double-minded man. In which case, if he's double-minded, we don't care if he got an administrative settlement before. The guy just goes on like one thing is not related to another, and the guy does not know how to operate his proceedings to get himself a remedy. So we have to warn you, like we said before, most all patriots fail in what they're doing by acting non sequitur in the events that transpire over the calendar days and weeks and months and years in series of time. You've got to stay consistent on the issues, or else, again, you cannot come forth into the tribunals to get your remedy. Okay. Good question. Gene Keating came out, about 6 months ago and said, who is it that's really running the prison system? Mortgage and securities companies, right? And he said that the entities that are running the prison system are all of these little legal and financial entities that have been set up, and they've been set up on what basis as a foundation? Didn't he say that discovery into the prison systems of America as they were structured on what was called a REIT, an R-E-I-T. What is a REIT? Real Estate Investment Trust. What does real estate investment have to do with people in prison? Buy the land, build the prisons? Okay. In other words, you're looking at the REITs as the facilities that hold the prisoners, the system and the facilities implementing the system that holds the prisoners. Is that your answer?
They buy the land,
and then they build a prison system. In other words, fences, razor wire, cell doors, cafeterias, recreation halls, sleeping quarters, and rooms for the guards to have their break and watch TV. That's the REITs. And then they rent those out as a warehouse to put all these prisoners in, right? Fair answer. Is there a better answer, Caleb? I love to interrupt his peaceful watching of his recording equipment.
Only if they consider the bodies real estate.
If they consider the bodies real estate, why would they do that?
They're vessels.
Well, is real estate vessels? Bob, where does the body come from? The soil of the land. and to the land it will return. So man and woman are portable real estate. And so the rights are the investment in the bodies of the prisoners because they're portable real estate. From the soil they have come and to the soil they will go. So it's a real estate investment trust. Instead of the soil being in the land, it's portable, movable soil. It's the bodies of the men and women. But that's all they are, is real estate. Real estate investment trust. They're telling you exactly what they're doing. It's just that we don't see the bigger picture. Scripture tells us that men and women are nothing of the but from the dust of the land, and to the dust of the land will return. So they're investing in mobile, portable real estate. That's all they're doing. It was interesting. Gene Keating called me up and said, you know, he says, I've been investigating this nulla contendere. And he said, if you go in to the rules of court by way of the evidence rules, he says, you find something very interesting in evidence rule 410. Evidence rule of 410 says the following. Inadmissibility of pleas, offers of pleas, and related statements. Rule of evidence. 410A. Except as provided in Division B of this rule, evidence of the following is not admissible in any civil or criminal proceeding against the defendant who made the plea or who was a participant personally or through counsel in the plea discussions. 1. A plea of guilty that later was withdrawn. 2. A plea of no contest or the equivalent plea from another jurisdiction. 3. A plea of guilty in a violations bureau. 4. Any statement made in the course of any proceeding under Rule 11 of the Rules of Criminal Procedure or equivalent procedure from another jurisdiction regarding the foregoing pleas. And 5. Any statement made in the course of a plea discussion in which counsel for the prosecuting attorney or for the defendant was a participant and that do not result in a plea of guilty or that result in a plea of guilty later withdrawn. Gene Keating was concerned about the following. Except as provided in Division B, evidence of the following is not admissible in any civil or criminal proceeding against the defendant, including a plea of no contest. So you plead no contest, and they can't use that plea in any civil or criminal case. Wait a minute. When you plea no contest, what are you saying? That you agree with the facts in the charging instrument, right? But it says, we can't accept your plea of no contest, even in this case in which you pled no contest. Unless something else is done. Now, it says, go to B, those are the exceptions. So we can accept your no contest plea in this case if it's an exception under B. B, unless a statement otherwise inadmissible under the rule is admissible in either of the following. 1. Any proceeding in which another statement made in the course of the same plea or plea discussion has been introduced, and the statement should, in fairness, be considered contemporaneously with it, i.e. the plea of no contest. What are they saying? They're saying we can't accept a plea of no contest as having any effect on this case unless there's another statement brought into the proceedings which in fairness should be considered contemporaneously with your plea of no contest. What are they looking for?
Counterclaim.
In other words, a plea of no contest without any other statement, i.e. a counterclaim and evidence, means nothing. How about those apples? In other words, Rule 410 is saying if you want to plead no contest and it's going to have any effect, you better support that plea of no contest with some other statements or something which has something to do with what the court ought to consider in all fairness in this matter. So the rule of evidence tells you under Evidence Rule 410 that a nulla contendere plea without a counterclaim and evidence is going nowhere. Next issue. Gene Keating was very concerned about this plea of no contest. And so what he did is he started looking up some case law, which is what Gene Keating does the best at. And he came across, when he started looking up this Evidence Rule 410, he came across a reference in the annotated version of that rule that said, go to the case of Hudson versus United States, 272 U.S. 451. It's a 1926 case. And in that case, Gene started researching that case and the other cases that were referenced to it and found out that a plea of nulla contendere, no contest, dates way, way back in history into the ancient days of common law pleadings in the king's courts in England. And that the plea of nulla contendere in these common law courts was a plea to the king for forgiveness by admitting the facts in the charging instrument. And that the purpose in admitting the facts by no contest and asking the king for forgiveness was basically to get the king's justice to basically ameliorate the punishment and to take the imprisonment away from the crime and substitute thereby a small fine in its place. What have we been saying in terms of trying to resolve criminal cases? By acceptance, return, and request for settlement and closure. Haven't the attorneys for the defendants come back and said, you can't do that because, why? This is criminal, this isn't civil. What Gene Keating just found out by researching the history is the nulla contendere converts the cases from criminal to civil by ancient pleadings. Let's go through what the United States Supreme Court said in this written case, Hudson versus U.S. Petitioners were indicted in the District Court of Western Pennsylvania for conspiracy to use or for using the mails to defraud, crimes punishable by fine or imprisonment, or both. On pleas of nulla contendere, they were sentenced to imprisonment for 1 year and 1 day. The conviction and sentence were affirmed by the courts of appeal for the Third Circuit. The case is here to the United States Supreme Court on certiorari. The sole question raised by the assignment of error is whether a United States court, after accepting a plea of nulla contendere, may impose a prison sentence. Isn't that the issue of whether they're going to continue it as a criminal case or a civil case? It is the contention of petitioners that the plea, in effect, is conditioned upon the imposition of a lighter penalty. That, therefore, the court may not accept the plea to an indictment charging a crime punishable by imprisonment only, and if accepted where the crime is punishable by imprisonment or fine or both, it may not accept the plea and ignore the condition of imposing a prison sentence. This contention is supported by Tucker versus United States, 196 F260, 116 CCA 62, 41 LRA 70, Shapiro versus United States, 196 F268, and Bloom versus United States, 196 F269, in which sentences of imprisonment on a plea of nolle contendere were set aside. But in United States versus Lair, 195 F47, habeas corpus was denied a petitioner confined for a 2-year term upon his plea. However, the objection pressed were apparently was neither raised nor considered. So when the guy put in a habeas corpus, he didn't raise the issue of, hey man, you accepted the nolle contendere plea, you can't put my ass in jail. Never raised the issue in the case in which he didn't get a remedy. The use of the plea in federal courts and the propriety of imposing a prison sentence upon it are recognized by the Probation Act, March 4th, 1925. Section 1 of that act provides for the suspension of sentence and the release of the prisoner on probation after conviction or after a plea of guilty or nolle contendere for any crime or offense not punishable by death or life imprisonment. A plea of nolle contendere was known to the common law and is referred to, although not by name, by the modern English text writer, C. Archibald's Pleadings, Evidence, and Practice in Criminal Cases, 1922. But no example of its use in the English courts has been found since the case of Queen versus Templeman decided in 1702, where although a fine was imposed, the question now under consideration was neither decided nor discussed. The view of the court in the Tucker case, which we talked about earlier, that a prison sentence may not be imposed upon the plea of nolle contendere, rests upon no more substantial basis than a possible ambiguous phrase in a passage from Hawkins' Pleas of the Crown, 8th edition, Book 2, Chapter 31, page 466. The author prefaces the chapter, quote, of confessions and demurs, unquote, with the remark, quote, and now I am to consider what is to be done to a prisoner upon his confession, which may be either expressed or implied, unquote. So like Jean intimated to me, the plea of nolle contendere is an awful lot like the common law plea in civil cases of confession and avoidance. In sections 1 and 2 of that book, Hawkins points out that a confession of guilt, quote, carries with it so strong a presumption of guilt that an entry on record, and then he goes into some Latin, in an indictment or trespass, estops the defendant to plead not guilty to an action brought afterwards against him for the same matter. But that was on a plea of guilty, not no contest. He then says, Section 3, an implied confession is where a defendant, in a case not capital, does not directly own himself guilty, i.e., I'll plead not no contest, but not guilty, but in a manner admits it by yielding to the king's mercy. In other words, the plea of no contest is, I admit the facts, but not guilt, but I'm asking for mercy. Don't put me in prison. That's what it's all about. And desiring to submit to a small fine, in which case if the court think fit to accept of such submission and make an entry that the defendant, again Latin, without putting him into a direct confession or plea, which in such cases seems to be left to discretion, the defendant shall not be estopped to plead not guilty to an action for the same fact as he shall be when the entry is, and then again more Latin. This passage appears in all the earlier editions of Hawkins. It has been handed down from generation to generation of text writers in substantially the same form, which occasionally glosses, but researchers rarely went further. Similarly, judicial study of the history of the plea halts with Hawkins. So what are we hearing here? Nobody's ever changed their mind. The case law is well settled. A plea of nolle contendere is not a plea of guilty. That nobody's ever carried it and spoke about it in great length or any farther, but basically you're asking the mercy of the king's court to suspend any jail time associated with the criminal charges if the plea is received by the court. The question is, if the plea is received by the court, when should the court allow the plea to be received? If the counterclaim surely disposes of the substantive merits of the prosecution case, because it's a fiction, it should not exist. But in order to save face, we'll charge some token fine, let him settle the fine, and let the prisoner go home. Isn't that what we're saying? Voila. This discussion by the U.S. Supreme Court goes on. The author, neither here nor elsewhere, fulfills his promise, quote, to consider what is to be done to a prisoner upon his confession, unquote. It is to be noted that this and the preceding sections are directed only to the effect of the confession, which express or implied as an estoppel. He does not undertake to state with any certainty the precise effect of the implied confession upon the sentence. Putting oneself on the mercy of the king seems to have been at least an appeal for mercy, and at most a consent to be fined. If let off with that, not a plea, but a petition, the rejection of which may possibly have required a plea. In other words, if you didn't accept the nolle contendere, you'd have had to put in another plea. The text states the rule of law that has never been questioned, that the implied confession, as contrasted to the express confession, does not stop the defendant to plead and prove his innocence in a civil action. But even if we regard the implied confession as a petition, which in Hawkins' time had to be accepted as tendered, in modern practice it has been transformed into the formal plea of nolle contendere. Like the implied confession, this plea does not create an estoppel, but like the plea of guilty, it is an admission of guilt for the purposes of the case. Section 3, it is true, speaks of the defendant yielding to mercy in his desire to submit to a small fine. But even if we assign to these words the more comprehensive meaning suggested, they do not say that the court is bound to yield to the prisoner's petition in fixing sentence, nor do they suggest that the court, by accepting a formal plea which admits guilt for the purposes of this case, would be bound to yield to its implied appeal for mercy. Now, notice everything they said in the previous paragraph, they seem to be taking back in this one, right? They say, hey, in modern times, we can put the guy in jail if we want. Well, what are they saying colorably in this paragraph? They're saying just because he goes to enter the plea doesn't mean the court's bound by it. Why? Because maybe he hasn't added the extra facts in the counterclaim. So just because he comes in to offer so that he thinks we're going to accept it, so that he doesn't have to go to jail, that's not the way things are. The court has discretion. That's what they're saying here. But it has discretion based on what? The counterclaim and the evidence in support thereof. That's what they're saying. In other words, this paragraph is saying, hey, look, man, the guy can go through all the procedures that he wants, thinking he's not going to go to jail, but if he has no substance and no settlement issue to come in for the discretion of the court, the court is not duty-bound to grant what it is that he seems to be seeking, like no jail time, just because he's trying to enter a plea of no contest. The Supreme Court goes on. The genesis of the phrase, quote, desiring to submit to a small fine, unquote, used by Hawkins indicates unmistakably that its purpose was illustrative only. The authorities cited by Hawkins are Lambert's Aaronarcha, Book 4, Chapter 9, and then goes on with a bunch of older texts. The pertinent passage in Lombard is, quote, as where he putteth himself in gratiam reginae, and then he goes on with more Latin, without any more, what is this without any more? He put himself to the court by his petition without any more, no counterclaim or Rule 410B. Just the plea in and of itself, without the evidence and without the counterclaim, means nothing. So, without any more, or by protestation that he is not guilty, pleadeth his pardon. And such a confession, if I may so call it, doth not so conclude him, but that he may afterward plead not guilty in any action brought against him. In other words, he gets his nolle contendere, that his acceptance of these facts are not going to be used against him in another case. The authorities cited as in Hawkins are, and then it goes back to 9 Henry the 6th at 60 and 11 Henry the 4th at 65. In the same chapter, Lombard, in the passage for which no counterpart is found in Hawkins, unless it be the phrase already considered, queries that the justices may reject the plea and in consequence drive the party either to an absolute confession for increase of the fine or to his traverse, that failing therein, he may be imprisoned and fined also. So he can plead guilty or not guilty if they don't accept his nolle contendere. Why wouldn't they accept the nolle contendere? It's no counterclaim and no evidence. But this query leaves it uncertain whether the reduction of sentence following the implied confession is a matter of right upon which the prisoner may insist or discretionary with the court. Of the reports from the yearbook cited both by Hawkins and Lombard, isn't it interesting, in the 1926 U.S. case, where are they going back for their foundation on their ruling? England. Ancient England, not just even contemporary England, common law, okay? As in the reports of the yearbook deals with express confession, the extract from 9 Henry the 6th is a colloquy between counsel and the court. The translation is printed in the margin. Its effect is that if one indicted for trespass has put himself on the grace of our Lord and King and asked that he might be allowed to pay a fine, his plea, if accepted, does not stop him from afterwards pleading not guilty. In other words, if they reject his plea, he could come back and plead not guilty. But remember, not guilty is a dishonorary plea. But that doesn't answer our question. We have here the same illustration used by Hawkins and Lombard properly applied, as the case was one of trespass. But there is no suggestion that would warrant the conclusion that a court, by the mere acceptance of the plea of nolle contendere, would be limited to a fine in fixing sentence. Fitzherbert merely digests this yearbook case. A citation to Freesley, 40, added in the later editions of Hawkins, is the case of Queen versus Templeman in Salkeld, to which reference has already been made. We think it clear, therefore, that the contention now pressed upon us not only fails of support in judicial decisions other than those of the Seventh Circuit already noticed, but its historical background is too meager and inconclusive to be persuasive in leading us to adopt the limitation as one recognized by the common law. Undoubtedly, a court may, in its discretion, mitigate the punishment on a plea of nolle contendere and feel constrained to do so whenever the plea is accepted with the understanding that only a fine is to be imposed. But such a restriction made mandatory upon the court by positive rule of law, what's that? Statute of the legislature, would only hamper its discretion and curtail the utility of the plea. Utility of the plea? That's the substance upon which the counterclaim was based. So it said, judgment affirmed. So in this particular case, these suckers here did not get out. Okay? But we don't know what else is going on in the background. We know that from the case law, basically, that if they had presented a counterclaim, then they should have not been in prison. Does that mean because a court accepts a plea of nolle contendere that it cannot put the person in jail? No. Happens all the time, doesn't it? Some guy comes in and let's say he was drunk driving again for his 59th time. And he comes into the court and he pleads nolle contendere. Why? Because there was an accident and he wanted to make sure that he doesn't get sued out of a confession and admission in the court, right? Will the court allow him to plead nolle contendere? Most likely. Does that mean that the court cannot sentence him to jail time? No. But what happens if the guy who was charged with that came in, pled nolle contendere, and had a counterclaim with evidence that under the circumstances, the substance of the case, he was not drunk driving and should not have gone to jail? The court has discretion based on the counterclaim and the evidence then to suspend the jail sentence. And they can go ahead and do that. So in this case, we heard that what was the purpose of nolle contendere in common law? Confession and avoidance. Confession, what happens when you go to the church and you ask for forgiveness of your sins? Confession and avoidance. What happens when you go to court and you ask for forgiveness of your sins? Confession and avoidance, you pay a small penalty, but you're not incarcerated under the execution of the law because you came there humbly and you confessed your sins and asked for forgiveness. So aren't most of the courts today ecclesiastical courts? And so if you come there asking for forgiveness by a confession, they're supposed to mitigate the execution, give you a penalty of some sort lesser, and send you on your way. If they receive the request for forgiveness, what if you go before the priest and you say, "Priest, forgive me my sins," and he says, "Well, you know, this is about the 15th time today you've been in here asking for forgiveness for that same sin. I don't think you're really very contrite in your heart, so we're not accepting your offer of plea, and we're not going to grant you the remedy that you're looking for, because the plea was not accepted." We're talking about the same difference here. Okay? So that's what we see going down. Okay? There were a couple of movies that came out over the weekend. None of them did very well. Actually, the stupid movie from a couple of weeks ago is doing much, much better than the movies that came out this week, and that includes a Bruce Willis movie, 16 Blocks. But nevertheless, the movie that came out this weekend that was the most frivolous and did the least amount of commercial business had a very interesting little theme to it. Now, I'm not suggesting everybody run out to see this movie, but the name of the movie is Aquamarine. In fact, most people probably won't go running out to see this movie because it's basically about a teeny bopper movie for girls. Not that I wasn't embarrassed to be the only one of four guys in the theater watching it, But nevertheless, my theory is usually the more frivolous the movie, the more truth it generally tells. And believe me, I was not disappointed in this particular movie. The story is a very simple story. It's a story about two teenage girls that are friends. Actually, they're probably about 12. And the one girl happens to live on this beach, which is a private beach down in Florida, which during the summertime, all of the boys and girls come to the beach to have a good time. And these two young girls, it's their summer of falling in love with the boy who sits on the tower looking over the lifesavers from the beach. And they're just absolutely infatuated by this young man who's 17 years old and a real hunk in their eyes. And they just keep dreaming that by the end of the summer, this lifeguard is going to love them for who they are, even though they're still only 12 years old. There is another issue which comes into play because the one girl is moving at the end of summer with her mother far, far away to Australia, and it's going to break up this friendship between these two girls who really need each other in life because both of these girls feel like they're not able to compete in their peers, in their school, and every place else. They're plain Janes, they think. They're not that smart, and they've got everything going against them, but they've got their friendship, and that's the only difference in the world, and it's going to pull them together as long as they're not separated. And so their whole summer is consumed with how are they going to turn around the fact the one girl's mother is going to take the one girl off to Australia and they'll never see each other again. Well, into the mix one day, a huge storm comes up, and when the storm comes up, the girls kind of make this little pact, and they make this prayer, oh, please, please, gods of huge storms, come upon us by your storm and create some miracle whereby the one girl who's supposed to leave will not be able to leave and she'll stay here forever. The morning following the bad storm, the beach was a wreck. The pool was destroyed. It had garbage and all kinds of stuff in it. And when the two girls went out of the building and started looking around, the one girl swore up and down that she saw something in the pool. And lo and behold, later on when they came back, they found out it was a mermaid. A young girl mermaid about their age. And the young girl mermaid that had been blown into the swimming pool was blown into the swimming pool as a result of this storm that was caused by the mermaid's father, who was the king of the oceans and the king of the deep. And he was very, very, very upset with his daughter, the mermaid, because the king of the deep had told his daughter that she would marry the man that the king of the deep had picked out for her to marry. And the mermaid did not want to marry the man of the deep. She wanted to find true love, and she wanted to marry for love and not out of duty and obligation to her father. And this young mermaid made it very imperative on the two girls that found her that she was not going back home to her father until she found love. And she implored the two young girls to help her find love, if at all possible, here on land. And so the two girls, looking at each other like we're having a hell of a time figuring it out and trying to find it ourselves, decided, well, what's in it for me? And the mermaid suggested that anyone that helps a mermaid do what it is the mermaid wants will get a wish. And that wish will come true, whatever that wish is for, as long as the wish does not violate any of the laws of nature. So the two girls are looking at each other going, hey, this is perfect. We can wish that there will be circumstances whereby we will never be separated. Your mother will have to stay here, so we'll go about the task of helping you find love. So they figured that the best thing to do is to pair up the mermaid with this hunk, this boy that they like on the lifeguard station at the club on the beach. Now it so happens that by day, the mermaid loses her fish tail and has legs. It turns out by night, the mermaid gets her fish tail back again. It also turns out that even though she has a good pair of legs to walk on by day, if the legs get wet with water, they turn back to a fish tail again, so she's got to be very, very careful. Well, needless to say, the two young girls set about trying to be the matchmaker and pair up the mermaid, whose name is Aquamarine, with the young hunk from the beach. The young hunk from the beach, of course, is not adverse to looking in the direction of women or ladies his age, and there is one teenager who thinks she is really the queen of the crop, and she has been trying all summer to win a date at the special event for the club at the end of the season, which is coming up in several days, and she will do anything to make sure that any competition is not there to intercede and to get this young man of her dreams away from her for the day. Well, as time goes by, you know that the mermaid and the young man are going to like each other, but time is drawing to a close because the mermaid's agreement with her father is she only had 3 days to find love. And if she did not find love in 3 days, she was to voluntarily return to the sea and submit to the marriage to the one that her father had picked out for her. 3 days were coming to a close, and she needed somebody to tell her that they loved her so that she would win the bet and would not have to marry the one that her father had chosen. And as time went by, the young man that she chose had more brains than most, and he was not looking for just any girl, but he was looking for a relationship of substance, not merely one of form. And even though Aquamarine asked him, "Do you love me?" the boy eventually said to her, "Well, it's not that I don't, and it's not that I might not, it's just that we have not been together long enough for you to know me and me to know you." In the end, she thought she had lost the bet and was returning to sea, but the girls that were looking for the promise so that they could get out of their own problems would not give up on the mermaid. And when she was swimming out to sea to return for her father, the girls swam out with her, risking their own lives, and said that they loved her and would give up their wish. And because of that, the contract with the father was broken, and the young girl did not have to marry the man that her father asked her to marry, or the fish or the squid or whatever it was in the sea. And it turns out that the young man also came out to meet her with the promise of a future relationship between the two. Now, I ask Caleb, what does this mean? Stop resting, Caleb.
And I answered it, don't you remember?
Go ahead. Go on the mic.
Just repeat what you said?
The only thing I recall you saying is, "Wait a minute, we got a break in the tape."
Oh. I said it sounds kind of fishy.
It sounds kind of fishy. You're absolutely right, Caleb, once again. So what does that mean?
I don't know. That was a stupid guess.
No, it was a wise guess. Isn't this a biblical tale?
Oh, yes.
See?
Yeah.
You're smarter than you think. It's a biblical tale. How is it a big biblical tale, Caleb?
Trying to think of the name. Swallowed by the fish.
Jonah?
Jonah.
In what way is it a Jonah tale? Beep. I think you're off track here a little, Caleb.
Okay.
I don't see a Jonah tale in there. You see a woman whose name was Aquamarine. That's a double witness to Admiralty, isn't it? Water and marine. Her jurisdiction and venue was of the sea. What was she looking for? Love. What is love? Fulfillment of the law. Did she find the law in Admiralty? No. Where did she come looking for the law? On the land. Her father said, "You got to do what I tell you." She said, "No, I don't think that's the way it works. It works according to law, cause and effect." He said, "Well, I'll give you 3 days. That's a commercial opportunity to bring a counterclaim." She went looking for the law on the land. Who does she find there? Two girls and herself, which are three girls. Who are the three girls? The church. Three is feminine completion. It's the church. Did they realize that they were the church who could find the law and restore the law? Not at first. They were just bumbling idiots trying to do whatever they wanted to do to achieve in their minds. But working together over a period of 3 days, they all of a sudden deviated from their goals, their individual goals, to do what? Support each other. So they truly became the church who rediscovered what? The law, which is love of each other. The three girls each supported each other to become the church knowledgeable. To which then what happened to the mermaid? The mermaid was invited to come on land by her two friends and continue to date the boy, at least of her infatuation, if it grew into love. And she said to her two friends, "No, I must return to my father for a period of time. And that does not mean that I cannot join you from time to time and be with you." So it's the story of the coming of age of the church. But still understanding that part of the church is in Admiralty and part of the church is in law. And by time we finished the story, we found out that the young mermaid girl was now in charge of her own life because she understood the law and its application, and she had the support of others in the church supporting her. And we find that the two girls that were on land that could have had the promise or the wish fulfilled, that would have stopped the mother from taking the one girl away, the two girls could now stand on their own feet and grow up knowing that they had to give up the close relationship in order to increase the ability in their lives to go on with their own existence and their own reason, and they no longer were supporting each other mostly by lack of understanding or out of fear or insecurity, they now had the security that the law brought to them. So you had a perfect little biblical allergy here that just went like nobody's business out of a frivolous, stupid little movie. Now, I'm sure it's a cute movie for young teenage girls. I don't think that many of the hunks are going to go down there and watch Aquamarine as being the greatest story of all time. But it's usually the most frivolous little thing that comes out of Hollywood that sometimes has the most interesting stories to it. So I thought you might appreciate once again that Hollywood is doing some interesting things. No, the sheriff's deputies weren't taking my picture when I went to that movie, I don't think, but hey, maybe.
They were out there getting your picture.
There you go.
Keep reading about this in the
Medina. Absolutely. Okay. I had a guy who's down south in Ohio here, and he's got a Title 42 lawsuit and case going. And, I probably should have brought my Black's Law Dictionary with me tonight. I brought everything except that. This guy has got a Title 42 lawsuit going, and he's got a city brought into it, and he's got a bunch of actors in the city brought into this. And the thing stems from a number of years ago in which the city sent a SWAT team into this guy's offices in a office building. They raided his place, they turned his office upside down, they arrested him and took him down, threw him in jail until he bonded out, and then they brought some kind of a case against him, quasi-criminal and everything, and eventually, this guy came back and brought a Title 42 lawsuit against them because he says they exceeded whatever authority they had. Now, all of this stems from the fact that they did an investigation on his straw man using the social security number, etc., into a number of different ways. And there's a federal statute which basically says that the social security number cannot be used by anyone unless they've got permission and consent. And he said, geez, I didn't give the city any permission and consent to do this. And they used the social security number. They did some investigations, and based on that and assumptions and presumptions, they raided the office. Now, they come back and they keep saying, oh, we're a government agency. We can use a social security number. Well, what happened is they didn't have a social security number on this guy because he didn't give it to them. What they did is the prosecutor or assistant prosecutor in this municipality called up a credit company. And they said to the credit company, we're running a credit check on this guy. And they said, well, what's his social security number? Well, we don't have that. But we do have the name and we do have the address and he's doing this and doing that and we could use that. And so based on the prosecutor basically making misstatements of truth to the credit company to make it appear as though they had permission, the credit company gave them a social security number, which is how they got it, and using the social security number, they assumed and presumed went forward then and did things. Okay, so it wasn't by voluntary consent. So this one of the big causes of this action is that they violated the federal statutes and stuff when the prosecutor lied to a credit company to get some evidence, which ordinarily they can't get unless they lied. And that's what they did, which is a violation of the statutes, the ordinances, and outside their bounds. And that was an act and an action, etc., which causes the culpability under the Title 42. Okay. So the part we're interested in is this case has been going on for a long while, and what eventually happened is that the attorneys for the city and the agencies and the individuals brought summary judgment motions into the court proceedings for judgment on the summary judgment motions asking for a dismissal of the Title 42 against the city and the individual actors. Well, when push came to shove, the court ended up dismissing the municipality and the agencies, but it maintained the suit against three or four individual actors. When that happened, there was an interlocutory appeal by the attorneys for the actors that went up to the appellate court saying that the court screwed up when they didn't dismiss the actors. And likewise, the guy who's the plaintiff in this case put a interlocutory appeal into the appellate court on the grounds that based on his causes of action, let's say he had five causes of action, including the one that said these people violated the statutes when they did this thing, which he was saying the city had a policy to do that. The magistrate in the lower court sent a recommendation to the judge saying, we're recommending that you dismiss them against all the entities, the city and every one of the entities other than the individuals, but we can keep these people in as individuals in the suit. And this guy came back and said, wait a minute, hold it. In my three or four or five claims of action, you really answered claim one, two, and three, but you never addressed four and five. And since you didn't address four and five, how can you dismiss the city and the entities because you've failed to allow me due process and equal protection against these other two issues here, which I raised, which you didn't answer in your recommendation. And so the issue now comes down as to whether the magistrate's recommendation was violating this guy's rights to have all of his claims addressed by the court instead of just a couple, because he feels that the courts don't want to address this really big issue because it's a political hot potato. Well, it went all the way up to appeals. It came back. He asked administratively for the magistrate to redo the report. The magistrate basically said no. And when it came down from interlocutory appeals, it was remanded back to the lower court, and an order came, once it was remanded back, an order came out of the magistrate again, which is the following. This matter is before the court pursuant to the order of general reference in the United States District Court for the Southern District of wherever to United States Magistrate Judge so-and-so pursuant to such reference. The magistrate judge reviewed the pleadings and filed with this court on December 5, 2005 report and recommendations, docket number such and such. Subsequently, the plaintiff filed objections to the report and recommendations, docket number such and such plus one. Defendants filed a response to plaintiff's objections, docket such and such plus two, and plaintiff filed a reply to the response, docket such and such plus three. The court has reviewed the comprehensive findings of the magistrate judge and considered de novo all of the filings in this matter. Upon consideration of the foregoing, the court does determine that such recommendations should be adopted. It is ordered that plaintiff's motion for ruling, going way back to the docket before, and for revision and or modification of the court's order of going all the way back to June 15th of last year, are denied. It is so ordered, signed by the United States District Judge, not the magistrate. What's going on here? Why isn't this guy getting his remedy? He's saying the court really hasn't resolved all of my pleadings. And he objected, and it went up to appellate court, came back down. Now it's before the United States District Court judge on a matter before the court pursuant to the order of general reference. What's going on? Any questions in anybody's mind? Pete doesn't have a clue. Caleb is sitting there. He's still considering the Jonah tale.
The fish has got to get in here somehow.
The fish has got to get in here somehow. Well, look it. You know, our little girl was half fish and half woman. Okay, woman is the basically feminine, the church. What's the fish got to do with it, Caleb? You know there's got to be a fish in there somewhere. Wasn't the fish the symbol of the early Christian church? Mm-hmm. So there's your girl for you. Okay. But that has nothing to do with this. Okay. Why isn't anybody asking me, doesn't it say this matters before the court pursuant to the order of general reference? Does it say this matters before the court pursuant to what the plaintiff was asking us to do? It's before the court based on the order of general reference. Anybody in here not know what an order of general reference is? Hands going up. Why didn't anybody say what the hell is an order of general reference?
Hey, what the hell is an order of general reference?
Thanks. Caleb has finally gotten off of Jonah and looking at the answer to the riddle, or at least the question to get to the answer to the riddle. Okay, if you look for order of general reference in the law dictionary, it doesn't come out that way. But if you look for reference in, let's say, Black's 7th edition, and then under reference, you look at a topic called general reference, you're going to find out that a general reference is pointing at an agreement. So let's read this over again and substitute the words. This matter is before the court pursuant to an agreement. What's that got to do with what's going on?
No controversy. You got it.
There's no controversy if there's an agreement. So why is it that our hero, the plaintiff, keeps objecting to the agreement? What happens if you object to the agreement? You're in dishonor, aren't you? If you object to the agreement, you're in dishonor. Who wins? They do. So I said to this guy when I called up, I said, it's not what you're saying, it's the manner in which you're proceeding. How can you object to an agreement? You're part of the agreement by the presumption. How can you object to what you've agreed to? If you object to what you agreed to, are you going to win or lose? Lose. Did he lose? Gee, that's a big surprise, ain't it? Back to the drawing. He said, well, what should I have done? Don't disagree to the agreement. Now, how in the world did it get to be an agreement? You know, I've been saying to this guy all along, I said, have you contacted the prosecutor in this case? Oh, yeah. Do you have an administrative procedure going down with him whereby you're trying to resolve it before you go before the judge or the magistrate? He says, well, we've started those proceedings. I says, well, how far are you along? Well, we're just barely to the point where we're getting the certificate of protest. I said, certificate of protest, it sounds to me like you're a pound too short, a day too long. See, what you need to do is you get the agreement with the prosecutor that the court hasn't resolved the whole case, and then you take the agreement in before the magistrate to have him have the other party show cause why we both haven't consented and agreed that this court hasn't resolved the whole issue. You don't come into the court and start arguing, you guys need to do this to resolve the whole issues, because you're arguing. And when you argue, you are going against the general reference, the presumed agreement that we've gotten before we got here. Now, if you didn't get a settlement before you got there, who proposed the settlement? The magistrate. What settlement did he propose? Anything he wanted. Whose settlement was it? Everyone's. Not just the magistrates, it's the general order of reference. It's everybody's agreement. I didn't agree to that. Yes, you did, when you submitted it to the referee because you hadn't resolved it before you got here. You agreed to allow him to do it. That's what referees are for. When the two parties disagree, the referee will give his statement, and you've agreed to disagree and allow the referee to resolve it. Now that's your order of general reference. So the judge is saying to this guy, based upon the fact that you guys all agreed, by not having agreed before you got to the referee, this is what we're going ahead on. Now, would you like to object and argue about it some more? That's why the court's decision is on the moon and makes no sense to him, because he didn't get the agreement before he took it into the court. And he allowed the referee to put out a general reference which says anything that the referee wants to say. It's on the moon, but it is the order of general reference, which means you agreed to it. Why are you disagreeing now? It's that simple. It's not the facts, it's the way they're brought to the court for resolution. That's what it's all about. Okay? So that's what's happening there. Okie dokie. There is a topic that I really wanted to go into, and it's just absolutely incredible. I think we're going to try to pick it up next week. The discussion that we want to get into is once again on the whole concept of corp souls. But I want to have some material here to be able to go through that, so that you will see what is truly happening in a corp soul environment, instead of corporations, partnerships, anything else. And I think you're going to be, with the background and the knowledge that we have right now, you're going to be absolutely amazed at what the entity of a corp soul allows us to do in terms of settlement and closures of civil and criminal matters. So we hopefully will be able to get involved in that then next week. The people that came here to see me had a couple of interesting issues going on, and they were pretty much right on point with most of the things they were doing. They just didn't understand some of the settlement and closure issues that we've been discussing that really help us understand more of what's happening. And by that, I mean the following. One party had trusts, and the party that had the trusts had a trustee and a trust promoter that set up these trusts for this party. And when they set those trusts up, they had a very good contract. They had all of the proper parties, the trustees, the beneficiaries, the grantors, etc., etc. But it appeared as though the party helping establish these trusts did not have a lot of running experience with applying these trusts to real situations. And as such, this party told the people using the trusts that you're going to do assignments of property from like one entity to another, like from yourself into the trust. And so everything that went on here in, from his point of view, the promoter teaching these people to use trust, is he said, you got to go out and do assignments, and you do assignments with real estate by deeds, you do assignments with bank accounts, by actually transferring the funds into an account with somebody else as the signature on the account. You do a transfer of personal property by a bill of sale, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So he said, really what you're doing is, quote, assigning your interest in this property, unquote. So everything these people did was, quote, assign their interest in property, unquote. Now, when the people started talking to me, usually if trusts are challenged, you've got to come up with minutes from the trust which state who's doing what, to whom, for what purpose, what consideration or cross-consideration is involved. And once you start doing that, my first question then was to the party is, you assigned your interest, is that correct? And they go, oh yes, we assigned our interest, because that's what they were told. You have to assign your interest. If you don't assign your interest, then nothing has changed. Okay? How did you assign your interest? Well, what do you mean? How did I assign my interest? I wrote a deed. Okay? Let's put it another way. What consideration changed hands? Oh, well, what do you mean? What consideration changed hands? You know, if you assign an interest in property, there could be tax consequences. There could be consequences as far as giving up control. There could be consequences as far as giving up equity. There's so many different factors that come into place. I'm saying you assigned your interest. How did you assign it? Well, Like I said, a deed. Let me make it easy for you. There's three ways you can assign your interest. Did you gift it? Did you sell it? Or did you exchange it? Did I gift it? I don't know. I'm not you. Let me put it this way. If you gifted it, then the other party did not give you any consideration for it. What kind of title has he now got without any consideration? If you gifted it, then the giver has a tax liability. Did you pay a tax and declare a gift? No. Well, maybe I didn't gift it then. Well, you said to me you assigned your interest. Don't you think you ought to understand what it is you did? Because depending upon what you did creates tax consequences, title consequences, and equitable consequences. And you're trying to suggest that somebody has rights, duties, or interests herein. And if you can't tell me how you, quote, assigned, unquote, your interest, I can't tell you who's got duties and beneficial interests of any kind. She said, well, I don't think we sold it. I said, well, if you sold it, did you report income and pay a tax? And if you sold it, there was an exchange of consideration, and if there was an exchange of consideration, then as a result of the assignment, at least the other party has got either control or equity or both, so at least we've got something going on there. And so I said to the party, is it possible you exchanged it? And the party, being in real estate, looked at me thinking in terms of real estate and said, no, I didn't exchange it because I didn't get any real property back within 9 months. I went, whoa, whoa, beep, hold it, wrong issue. Most of the time when assignments are made, when you are restructuring activities, either by corporations, partnerships, trusts, LLCs, basically, in order to prevent the majority of problems that come down the road, you neither gift them nor sell them, but you exchange them into the new entity. But an exchange requires equal for equal. But it's not a sale, so the equal is not denominated in an appraised amount of dollars. But neither is it a gift. And so the party said, well, what was the exchange? I said, well, let's take real estate. Before the entity, the trust, was established, wasn't the real estate in your name? Oh, yeah. Well, if you sold the real estate tomorrow, how much of the equity that the real estate is worth would you put in your pocket? And the party said, all of it minus whatever the costs were or any liens like a bank mortgage. I said, exactly. Let's say The property sold for $500,000 and you put $100,000 in your pocket. Now, let's create a trust and let's assign the real estate into the trust. And we're going to do that through the vehicle of a deed. But we're going to do it as an exchange, not a sale and not a gift. And the party says, well, how are we going to do that? I said, well, when we create the trust, if you're the beneficiary of the trust, 100%, and you assign the property into the trust, instead of owning the property as the owner, you will now have the equitable interest being the beneficiary of the trust 100%. So that once you assign it to the trust and deed it into the trust in the name of the trustee, if the trustee sold that property tomorrow and he paid off all the costs and expenses on it, and then you said to the trustee, or the trustee said, well, let's collapse the trust then, because we've sold the only asset in the trust, we don't need the trust anymore, how much equity would be in the trust before they distributed it to the beneficiary and collapsed it? $100,000, assuming the property sold for the same amount from the trustee as it sold from the party themselves. I said, have you got any increase in value over what you would have had you sold it yourself, or did you have any decrease in value over what you would have had you sold the property in your own name rather than put it in the trust by assignment through a deed and have the trustee sell it? The answer is no gain, no loss. It was an equal exchange. So you exchanged the piece of paper called the deed for a piece of paper called the certificates of beneficial interest in the trust. It was both pieces of paper. What is the value of the piece of paper called the deed? The net amount of money that would have been obtained from the property had it been sold with all of the debts taken care of. What is the value of the piece of paper called the certificate of beneficial interest in the trust? The value of what you would get in equity if all the assets in the trust were sold and all the expenses paid. So the value of the deed paper is equal to the value of the CBI paper, and it's an equal exchange, one piece of paper for another, and we haven't even appraised them because we don't have to. So it's not a sale and it's not a gift. Is there a gift tax due? No. Is there a gift form has to be filed? No. Is there a sales tax due? No. Is there any difference in equity and net worth? No. What happened when you put it in the trust? You lost control over the property. That's all you lost. So I said to this party, I said, to tell me that you did an assignment as far as accounting purposes and tax purposes and control and title purpose is meaningless. I don't know what the hell happened. But everything that trust promoter did for that party was to say, just assign your interest. What happens to the minutes? Well, I signed my interest. Are these minutes very valuable in determining the nature of the transaction? They're almost worthless. We don't know what happened here. Duh. What happens now if 2, 3, 5 years later, someone like the IRS or some other business associate wants to question what's going on and who's got who and who's got what and what rights and titles and control and interest are going on? Haven't got a clue. Because people are running a piece of machinery and they don't know what the machinery does and how to work the machinery. And the party that sold them the machinery or the concept of using it didn't know how to run it and use it themselves. So the problem is, if you're going to be doing something and operating a piece of machinery, if somebody else doesn't teach you what to do, if it's worth doing, go out and learn what it is you're doing and do it right. Because the consequences of not running the equipment correctly, but relying upon the equipment to get a job done, is going to be extremely frustrating if you don't do something correctly here. Now, another guy came up to me and said, hey, he said, you know, my parents are up in their 80s, and they went out to see this attorney, and this attorney set them up with this living trust. And they brought the living trust home, and it's a pile of paper about an inch thick here, and I don't think my mom and dad looked through it. I'm wondering if anything in what this attorney did here has any sense for these people or what they ought to be doing. And I said, well, let me look at the pile of paper here. So we started going through the paper, and I said, looks like the attorney set up a really neat living trust for your parents. Oh, he says, well, that's great. I says, maybe, maybe not. What are your parents trying to do? Well, let's see. Mom and Dad want to make sure nothing's going to go through probate. I said, well, is there a state less than $600,000 or $800,000? Oh, yeah, it's probably less than that. I said, well, there's good news and bad news then. The fact that it is a living trust means that it's going to go through probate, but there's probably going to be no taxes due. And the other good thing is, if they've executed all the documents, most likely they've already assigned, there you go with that word again, a successor to most all of their assets by way of the living trust. But it's still a living trust, and all the assets are included in their estate, notwithstanding the fact that they've already made an assignment if they've executed all the documents. So the guy looks at me and says, well, what does that mean? And I said, well, what do your parents want to do? If they didn't want to go through probate, they are, but in essence they're not. Because they're not going to have any tax liability. They've already assigned, if they've executed all the documents, all their property to a successor, and so it'll be a mere formality. He said, oh, good. I said, well, it depends. He says, well, what does it depend on? I said, well, what kind of health are your parents in? Do you think they may go into a nursing home someday? He said, well, I don't know, maybe. I said, well, the bad news is that as far as the living trust is concerned, it does not remove any of the assets from their estate, and if they have to go into the nursing home, all of their assets are subject to being levied for the cost of their health care as they get older if they do not stay healthy. And the guy absolutely exploded and said, what? We were supposed to be protecting them. I says, well, you should have told the attorney you didn't want a living trust then. You should have told him you wanted an irrevocable trust, because the way it stands right now, the assets are still in the trust. They can be attached by any kind of creditors whatsoever before their death, and there may not be anything left to transfer, even though it's already pre-programmed to go to successors. So the issue is, if you don't know what you're doing, you better seek some kind of advice and assistance, because assumptions and presumptions sometimes just don't cut these things when it comes to working within the terms of settling estates and commerce and everything else. You better know what you're getting, what you're purchasing. The good news is they didn't pay an awful lot of money for this living trust, but the bad news is they didn't get what they seemed to think that they wanted. And so now they're going to have to go out and redo some things. Now, once we started looking at the rest of the documents in the inch-thick packet, we found out that about the only thing that they executed in terms of the pre-drawn agreements was the deed to put the family house in the living trust, appointing a successor trustee if anything happened to the parents, which meant then that if the parents passed on, the successor trustee would have the property in his name or could easily have it transferred to his name through the probate court without any extensive work and would be able to sell a property. On the other side of the coin, the parents had not executed any of the other documents, including the savings account, the checking account, and the stock market account. So none of those properties would have transferred by way of the living trust upon their death and would all have had to have gone through probate. Neither had they dealt with the family automobile, which was not very valuable, or the camping vehicle, which did have a sizable value to it, both of which would have had to have transferred through actions in the probate court because they were not executed at all into the living trust. So once again, what's the purpose in going out and getting attorneys to draw up instruments if A, you don't understand them, B, if you don't execute them and put them into proper play, or C, they're not going to achieve the results that you want to achieve? So once again, the time to start looking at these things is when everybody's healthy, when everybody can figure out what it is they want to do, and not when we're in a panic at the last minute. The attorney had drawn up health care documents as far as powers of attorney for health care, durable powers of attorney for health care, durable powers of attorney, and powers of attorney for other commercial and legal title aspects in the family's lives. None of those had been executed, so that none of those were in any force and effect in the event anything would happen to mom and dad. Sometimes it's very difficult dealing with older people and getting them to even talk about these things or sign these things, which is probably a good reason for doing it when people are at a realistic age, maybe in their latter 50s or early 60s, when you broach these issues. It isn't like the sons and daughters are approaching someone and mom and dad is going, oh my God, they want me to sign the will. Do I look like I'm going to croak tomorrow type attitude? And the best time to do it is when everybody has their reason, logic, and common sense and you're doing it because it makes sense. But know what you're doing when you get into this. Okay, that'll be it for tonight. Next week, we'll try to take up this issue of corpse soul and see how it fits in terms of can we set up or establish a structure by which we should be able to get some political and commercial remedies. And then one of the other issues that we want to start talking on is an issue dealing with, are we going to try to settle these with a nulla contendere, which is almost like using the fiduciary, the captain of the vessel, to come in and settle these things by a discharge, or whether we're going to go back to the living man and woman to settle them by a set-off, an adjustment, or can the captain of the vessel bring forward the set-off and the adjustment in addition to the discharge? Now, the differences between those two are, a discharge means if in your pleadings by the nulla contendere you can show there's no substance to the charges brought by the prosecutor, then the judge, in the discretion based on your counterclaim and the evidence, should dismiss the charges criminally brought by the prosecutor. If he dismisses it, that's a discharge. We didn't pay it. We didn't settle the account by an offset. The court recognized that the charges were not based upon substance and they should be dismissed because the counterclaim shows them to be a fiction. That's a different approach than having the secured party creditor come in and use his exemption to apply a commercial offset to an account to basically pay the account down to a zero equity position, which is a closed or a discharged account. To put it another way, one of the things that some of the patriots are doing out there, including Winston Shrout, and remember, he's on Monday nights on Truth Radio, which is tonight from 9 to 10, so he's on the same time that we have our meeting here, basically, but you can go to www.truthradio.com and you can download his program on archive the next day on the Higher Ground Learning Radio program segment on Truth Radio through Pastor Massad, and you can find out what Winston is doing on that radio program. Also, Winston just had a seminar down in Las Vegas here the last couple of weeks toward the end of February, and I understand that that seminar should be available, but I don't know where to get it yet. When I find out, I'll let you know, or if somebody else finds out, please let us know so we can pass that on. But Winston Shrout has found out the following. Going back as many as 10 and 15 years ago, there were some patriots that found out that there is a government form 521. And this government form authorizes you to go into Social Security and basically withdraw from their benefits program. Why would one do that? Well, the issue is the benefits program through Social Security includes what? Limited liability. Isn't that what Admiralty is all about, limited liability? If you are a member of Social Security without having put in a Form 521, you're presumed to be engaging in the program of limited liability. Limited liability is a benefit. If you are accepting a limited liability benefit, you're subject to all the statutory provisions of the code. So the presumption is you go in with your Form 521 and you basically negate your interest in this limited liability benefits of Social Security and everything else. Question, does that get rid of the account? The answer is no. Most patriots thought, we're getting rid of that account. It's not your account. You can't get rid of it. But if you go in with a 521 and you say that I'm not interested in the limited liability benefits, you seem to no longer be eligible for unemployment insurance, for Social Security, for all these other good things. And you go, geez, that can't be good, can it? Sure it can. How can it be good? That's right. You don't need to receive the benefits of limited liability if you've got something better. What do you got that's something better? You've got exemption. To do what? To pay off all your liabilities, not to be limited in your liabilities. So if you do the 521 form and give up your limited liability, now you can reach the use of your exemption to offset all liability, which you don't care what the limits are. So once again, they held out a carrot thinking that if you came and grabbed the carrot, you'd be more interested in the carrot than in the carrot garden. And so what Winston is finding out is that by way of the 521, basically, you asseverate yourself, who's yourself? The living man. from the limited liability system. And then what can you do? As the living man, you can still be the captain of your vessel because the account's still there. And as the captain of your vessel, you can go out and accept all offers to offset them by way of your unlimited exemption to offset every cases. So you can either use offset or you can be subject to limited liability. What would you prefer to do?
Offset.
Okay? And all the procedure we've been talking about to settle all these matters is still in full force and effect because the account in Admiralty is still there, but the account in Admiralty now hasn't got a limited liability tag on it. The account in Admiralty goes, yes, this account can be used in whatever way, and by authority of the man, he can apply the offset to settle and close every case to any magnitude whatsoever. Now, the question is, how do you get that process done? Well, what did they set up in terms of their, quote, scheme to set up their limited liability Social Security system, and what venue and jurisdiction is it out of? It's out of Puerto Rico, which is a federal conclave or a federal property, so it's national because it's a territory of the United States. But what Winston is saying is that the treasurer of Puerto Rico is the proper party by which these international bills of exchange ought to be cleared when you've got the ability to use your full exemption to offset the cases or the claims. And so he is having some procedural remedies in Lucknow by literally doing the 521 form for the particular party as part of everything else we've been doing in the commercial system and petitioning for the remedy and release, I believe, through the clerk of court of the Federal District Court in Puerto Rico by petitioning the clerk of court to resolve the issues for the offset and closure of the cases by drawing the instrument on the treasurer of Puerto Rico. And so anybody interested in this should certainly be looking at what Winston is doing. And once again, it's just a little bit more and better understanding of what we're doing because Winston is saying, hey man, why would you want to be a part of a limited liability system when living men and women have an unlimited exemption to pay down an unlimited liability? You don't need limited liability. The limited liability is for the corporations which don't have the exemption, which operate in the fiction, whereas the unlimited exemption to deal with an unlimited liability deal with men and women, which you can access by the Form 521 into the record showing that you've abdicated the use of limited liability benefits. Okay, so that is it for tonight. We should be back, God willing, next week. Thank you.